Welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program to address the ramifications of change and how today's choices will affect tomorrow's community. This program is an extension and production of Action for Healthy Communities and provided in collaboration with KCBX. The program is made possible through underwriting by Joan Geller Sargent. I'm your host, Chris Kington Barker. It's been over 6 months since the hashtag MeToo movement began, and its effects continue to be widely felt across the nation. It seems that each week another media story is published. The movement, which began by exposing the abuses of powerful men in the media industry, has now spread to numerous other industries and occupations, as well as educational and governmental institutions. As a result, providers of sexual assault recovery assistance everywhere are seeing an increase in the need for their services and struggling to meet the needs of these victims as they're coming forward. My guests today have joined me to talk about what life is like after the hashtag MeToo movement and what we as a community can do to both help victims and decrease incidences of harassment and abuse in the future. I'm joined for today's show by Jennifer Adams, Executive Director for RISE, San Luis Obispo County, Chris Rodebush, MFT, therapist, and Christina Caviani, Director, Safer and Me and Masculinity Programs at Cal Poly in San Luis Obispo. This show is live, and you can be a part of our discussion by calling in today at area code 805-781-3875. Again, that's 805-781-3875, and thank you very much for joining me today.
Thanks for inviting us.
So, this is a big topic and where to start with all of this, but I think probably the first place is for people that may have been living somewhere where they haven't been aware of what's going on when we're talking about the hashtag MeToo movement. If people aren't familiar with that, maybe you can speak to what that is or what that has been.
So it started as a way really of people telling their own stories and saying that happened to me too, because there's a myth that it's something that is not common, when in fact a large percentage, often statistics state 1 in 4 women have experienced sexual assault. And so the Me Too movement kind of helped bring all of that out into the open. We have a culture that people are shamed and victims are blamed, and so therefore it's one of the most underreported crimes, and people tend to keep it to themselves.
And this really started with the media industry, with that whole movement of kind of coming out of the darkness, if you will, of underreporting, non-reporting. What do you think changed? What was that turning point?
Tipping points are interesting, right?
Yeah,
what causes them?
Yeah.
I mean, I've been doing this work for 20 years. And, you know, with each passing year, we've seen more and more, you know, coming to the surface, you know, starting with the Bill Cosby case several years ago, then the NFL, then we have things like Penn State, and now we have the gymnast doctor. And, you know, so as these cases, as people come forward, and more it's talked about, mm-hmm. we hit that tipping point mm-hmm. where it's like, okay, now everybody's coming forward with their stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how common, you said, gender-based biases, gender-based harassment,
violence,
1 in 4.
So 1 in 3, if you include all of it, and the percentages of people who have experienced and women who have experienced sexual harassment, I've seen studies that range anywhere from like 75% to 90% of women. I personally have never talked to a woman that hasn't experienced it.
I haven't either.
Yeah, me as well.
And I'm sure if people call in, they can tell their own story around that, too, about whether or not that's something that perhaps there are people that have not experienced that. I don't know.
Well, and what we find so often in our trainings is that people don't identify it until they actually have it explained to them what it is. Yes. Yeah. Same with sexual assault. Oftentimes we categorize that as bad sex, and I'm putting my air quotes up. And so until it is defined as something that happened that you didn't want to, and you didn't have the ability to say no or to remove yourself from the situation, oftentimes victims don't even identify it as such.
Yeah, and to add to the movement, I think one of the reasons it snowballed is, one, that there, when you see a number of stories coming out about it, there is some safety in knowing that you are not alone. Mm-hmm. And additionally, people who may have past traumas, when it's being talked about in the media, it's happening in common conversations with friends and social groups. And so it's unearthing some past traumas, and it's bringing that, which may be locked away in a cabinet, back to the forefront of your mind, back to your memory, and it's affecting your day-to-day life. And so it's more likely to be talked about.
And as a marriage and family therapist, then you're seeing that recurring for people.
Yeah, and I work at RISE as a therapist as well as in private practice. And I see that when things happen in the media, it affects their daily life if there's a historic trauma.
Does that speak to the question that comes up of why now? I mean, why would somebody report something that happened in 2001 when all these years have passed and they've gone through life, but now all of a sudden it becomes a crisis? And I think it seems hard for some people to understand the magnitude of that.
That is a great question, and a question that is very commonly asked of why people wait, why don't they report immediately? And I will speak to this, but I would love my peers to chirp in. But it is not always easy to report. The process of reporting is scary. It's invasive. It can have great benefits, and it could also be a secondary trauma. Working with people that don't know you, you're telling something that's highly intimate to a stranger. And a lot of the detectives in our county are fantastic in handling that space. And even in when you do, even when you do that, it is still very important. It is still very intimidating. And knowing the statistics of success of prosecuting crimes like this, sometimes that can be disheartening. It could be emotionally invasive. And then also there's a fear of not being believed.
Yeah.
And that is a big reason. If the first person I tell after a trauma minimizes it or doesn't believe me, I may not tell another soul the rest of my life.
Right.
And so that's another reason why people don't report. It gets minimized. They, like Jenny was just saying, they don't actually believe that it was an assault, or they don't believe that law enforcement can do anything about it.
And I think it's important to distinguish between reporting to law enforcement and telling someone in your circle.
Yeah.
Because oftentimes victims will tell people close to them. Mm-hmm. And then we get to the problem of what Chris was saying, that if they're not believed. And unfortunately, our culture up until this point, and this is where we're seeing the tipping point, blamed victims so that if something does happen to you, and you blamed yourself.
Right.
Because that's the messages that we're getting in the media is, oh, that, you know, if that happened to me, then it's my fault. And then, so you're not going to want to tell anyone.
Let's talk about some of those situations, because I think they're so commonly expressed. Why were you in that place? You know, what are some other kind of blaming questions that come up?
Alcohol.
Yeah.
Alcohol. Why were you drinking?
Yeah. Why were you by yourself? What were you wearing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what? You didn't know that person well. Why would you have trusted them? Yeah.
Well, and the truth of the matter is that 75% of sexual assaults happen between two people who know each other. So they're in that inner circle, and oftentimes, and I wanted Christina because I think talking about what happens on college campuses really highlights those main fallacies that we have around it.
Yeah. I mean, we have most majority of our assaults have alcohol as a factor, mm-hmm. alcohol and potentially other drugs. And, you know, the students who are become victims a lot of times have talked to their parents, and parents say the stereotypical things. You know, I thought you were saving yourself for marriage. Who were you with? What were you wearing? How much alcohol did you have? And friends might say that. Law enforcement might say that unintentionally, not trying to inflict harm, but asserting that it's something that they could have prevented, when the advocates and the people that are responding to them are trying to allow them to feel the empowerment that it's never the victim's fault. It's not their, it wasn't their choice.
Mm-hmm.
And in the college setting, our students are, you know, they're working really hard to get good grades. There's a lot of pressure at Cal Poly specifically for grades. And so it's kind of that play hard, party hard mentality. And there is a whole scene of the hookup scene and sex scene that happens specific to college students that I think other age ranges deal with, but it is very, very specific to the campus setting, and how to, you know, intervene at age 18 to educate. You know, we do a lot, but yeah. a lot of time, you know, I've been now at Cal Poly for, this is going to be my 10th year, and I always have that feeling that, gosh, I wish we could get to these young people earlier, because by 18, a lot of the, you know, values and the way they have looked at the world is really soaked in. So, you know, there's so much more potential to be happening at an earlier age that I would love to see happening in our community.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, how common is it for someone to falsely report a rape when it has been consensual, regrettable sex?
So there's been a ton of research on this, and this is one of those huge myths that's been easily debunked for decades. It has the same false reporting rates as sexual assault does as any other crime. And that's it's usually around 2%. It can be as high as 4%, but it's a very small number.
But it's as though the assumption is that that is a much higher percentage.
Correct.
We act as if it is.
Correct. Yeah. We do. We have, it's, you know, I always say you take something that the majority of people and the world participate in, mm-hmm. which is consensual sex, and you take away one thing,
yeah.
consent,
yeah.
and now you have a crime.
Yeah.
And so the problem is not understanding consent and, you know, how to have healthy relationships and healthy sexuality. You know, we have a long history in our country of not even wanting to talk about sex education in schools.
Right.
And so it's a much bigger issue. If it was as simple as there's some bad people out there that are committing all the rapes, that would be a very different, mm-hmm. different conversation. Mm-hmm. But this is something that's deeply rooted in our culture and happens on a continuum, which is why we start talking about sexual harassment so much, because in a culture that allows that and even encourages people on the receiving end of it to look at it as a compliment.
Right. Yeah, well, you know, he was attracted to you, you know, gosh,
right.
What's wrong with that?
Right, right. And we talk about stalking the same way. Oh, you know, he just must really be in love with you.
Yeah.
And, you know, our Disney movies feed things like
yeah.
that and ideas like that. And
yeah.
so
yeah.
It's,
you know, I was, it's our languaging changing, because before we used to call it date rape. And that to me doesn't say the same as a sexual assault. They're very different. One implies, you know, you were kind of out having a good time and something happened and maybe there was some consent that was there and it just went astray. And another really implies that, no, there wasn't. I mean, are we really getting into the languaging of things more rather than trying to make it look nicer than it is?
I think what comes up for me when I hear that is the word rape. Often, I think there's a physical violent component mm-hmm. that is somehow attached to that. And that doesn't necessarily mean, like, you could be sexually assaulted without actual physical yeah. violence taking place. And so I think
talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so there are many different ways that people can be pressured, coerced, or threatened into doing something that they don't want to do or be a part of. It can be circumstantial. So, for example, if somebody is in a foreign country and find themselves at somebody else's home and they're being pressured and that person is their way back to their hotel and they don't know what they're doing and they are stuck there.
Yep.
And it's, you know, the middle of the night and it can be something of physical size where somebody's not actually putting your hands on you, but they have their... they're very imposing in their body and threatening. It can be judgmental words. It can be nobody's going to believe you. And it could also be surprising. It can be something that we had this conversation. I thought we were on the same page. Mm-hmm. And somebody goes ahead and does something that you had already mm-hmm. explicitly said you did not want to do.
Mm-hmm.
Or you're asleep. There's so many different ways mm-hmm. that an assault can happen without threatening with a weapon or physical violence. Those things still do happen, but I just want to be aware that harassment and that pressure and coercion can happen mm-hmm. in many different ways and in relationships and marriages.
Yeah.
So
yeah. I think, you know, the point is that there's a big difference between consensual and feeling that you do not have a choice.
Right. And on our crisis lines and when we're dealing with people who are coming forward, that's always our first question, because they're questioning whether they whether what happened to them is rape or not. Right. And that's usually the how the conversations start off. And for our services and for Safer Services, our question is, did you want that to happen?
Yeah.
And if the answer is no, then our services are for you. Now, figuring out whether it's a crime and how it's reported to law enforcement, that's a much deeper, longer conversation. And people, it's important for people to understand that the laws are different by state as to what's illegal and what constitutes that. And there's all kinds of things that come into play, like people's ages and what body parts are involved and right. all kinds of things. And it's also important to understand sexual harassment is not a crime. And, you know, we get asked that a lot since the Me Too movement came forward. You know, that is something that is a civil issue, that it is addressed in places of employment and places of education. It is not a crime. And so it's not something that can be reported to law enforcement.
Yeah. And give an example of the kinds of sexual harassment that frequently come up.
You want to talk about that a little bit, because you hear a ton on campus.
Yeah. So I think we see that in the form of, you know, we have a large engineering department that's more male dominated. So if there's two female identified students in the class and then there's 60 males and there's jokes about sexual jokes about women, there's comments about how they're dressed. They're in a, you know, that's actually very common. There's jokes about pornography, this, whether it be by the student or the faculty themselves, that is creating an environment that is hostile and where sex and gender is at the kind of crux of it, and it makes students uncomfortable, specifically those two female students.
Mm-hmm.
Faculty that are, you know, holding office hours and close the door, not thinking about how, you know, they're engaging with the people that are their students, and likewise, you know, and I think we see it with in the employment realm as, you know, people touching shoulders, massaging shoulders, people asking someone to get drinks when they've said no, and they're your supervisor. So there's a role of power in that dynamic typically, so that you feel like you have to say yes because they're your professor, they're your supervisor, you need a letter of rec from them, you need your performance evaluation. And so we see it often.
And so, you know, this really, that gets into an area that where is the line in that? Because what I hear from the male side of that is, you know, okay, how do we know where the line is? where the limit is. And I hear that from women too, of wow.
And that's where we have to have conversations, mm-hmm. right? That's where we have conversations. And, you know, there's a lot of things put into place on Cal Poly campus around sexual harassment. So there's a lot of steps and a lot of support around that. And, you know, I've had tons of conversations with men where they're like, I didn't realize that. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize that was not okay. And it's like, okay.
Is it up to us as women to speak up and say that's not okay?
So yes and no. And it's up to men. And that's one of the exciting things that we've been involved in as Rise and Safer is men's involvement in this movement. And we're seeing that more and more as well. And that is about men calling each other out on behaviors that they know mm-hmm. is not okay. And stepping up to their friends and colleagues and saying, hey, you know, do you know when you said that, or did you realize, or did you see the look on her face? That was not okay.
Yeah.
And just to jump in there, one word that you said that jumps out at me, and maybe it's just because I'm a therapist, but communication, communication, communication. If you are worried that something you said might not be appropriate, if you ask your partner, do you like this? Do you not like this? These are ways that we can avoid a lot of things.
Yeah.
If people talk, if people ask, and find out. If you don't know, ask. That's kind of the rules of the game.
It kind of necessitates people not operating living in a vacuum, doesn't it?
No way.
Well, and the other thing to think about, because I think about my grandfathers, both my grandfathers who I loved and adored. I think back and about the things and jokes that they would tell and the things that they said. And like, oh, my goodness, totally, you know, crossing lines.
Right.
But they grew up in a time and a place where that was acceptable. And so I know they're both gone now, but I would have been able to have a conversation with them and explain to them. And it would have been hard. And I don't know that they would have totally changed their behavior right off the bat, but we would at least open up and have a conversation about it.
Right. Talk a little bit about the men's program and how that's being integrated. Talk about it from the campus.
So we, a few years ago, got funding to start a men and masculinity program. So that program has a full-time coordinator and student assistants and a space. And that program is offering educational opportunities for students to engage with men and male identified as the focus of that action. So where women typically have been the ones doing the work to prevent sexual violence, intimate partner violence, this program is really geared to start the conversation with males as well as females, mm-hmm. but really focused in on specifically on targeted male groups on campus as well, like athletes and fraternity members and clubs and orgs that are male dominated, to really motivate them to be those change agents. And also engage the community, Cal Poly community, around how preventable this is, so that if we know that majority of perpetrators are male and we can engage them in the discussion and get them to do what Jenny just was describing, to speak to their friends, to stand up, to really change the culture,
right.
Because that's not how it's been, is really the hope at the end of this tunnel, that we could change it if we really could engage this 99% of males that, you know, are thinking or considering changing their behavior, because the majority of men are not perpetrators.
Right.
They're bystanders.
Right.
They're thinking it through and not knowing what they should do in a sexual situation.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them, just like we talked about with victims, don't realize that they are victims until we explain it. It's the same for perpetrators. They don't realize they've harmed until we come and talk about it, and they're sitting there thinking, oh my gosh, that's how I've had sex and dated people the last 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh, I've raped people.
Yeah.
So we talk to a lot of students that are going through that experience, and I mean, that program is really changing the trajectory of someone that could be harming, you know, 5, 10, 20 people to really thinking, wait, I don't want to do that. I want to go down this other path. So yeah. it's been wonderful.
That's great. Yeah. I want to talk more about the results of that in just a minute. I'm Chris Kington Barker, and you're listening to Central Coast Voices on KCBX, HD1 San Luis Obispo, KNBX, HD1 San Ardo, and KSBX Santa Barbara. The hashtag MeToo movement continues to have an impact across the nation. Today I'm visiting with guest Jennifer Adams, Executive Director for RISE San Luis Obispo County. Chris Rodebusch, yes, marriage and family therapist, and Christina Caviani, director Safer and Me and Masculinity programs at Cal Poly SLO. You too can bring your voice to our discussion today, and we welcome you. You can join us by calling in to 805-781-3875. Again, that's 805-781-3875. 3875. And going back to you, Christina, what kind of has been the response from the males? I mean, you mentioned that for some of them, it's like this epiphany that their behavior was something that they were totally unaware of, and the impact could have been negative, right?
Right. Yeah, I mean, we have been able to talk with over 3,000 male students last year about what is the Men and Masculinity program. So that just having a banner that says that, everyone's like, what is that?
Are they approaching you, these 3,000?
Yes. We also go into classrooms, okay, and go, you know, intentionally provide educational workshops where we invite people in, and we work with faculty to be able to do that as well. But it's just, we have a booth and we have cookies a lot of times, and people want free food. So, and they're,
we'll take it.
Yeah.
That's not to say that if you want men to come and participate, you feed them. Right. That's not to say that.
No, anyone, any student is happy to take free pizza and cookies and food. Yeah. So, yeah, I think we, you know, there's just the fact that people are, what is men and masculinity? Why is there a program? We're still, yeah, kind of there. You know, we're still, it's not like, oh, of course there's a men and masculinity program. That makes total sense. So we're, yeah, still in the phase of trying to explain why it's necessary. We do events throughout the year, and we also provide a restorative justice program. So if a male is accused and his case is substantiated, one of the sanctions is to go through a 6-week program with our men and masculinity coordinator. So it's a 6-week program, and it's all focused on education and restoring this person to be able to have healthy relationships in the future.
Okay, and let's talk. Speaking of men, let's talk to Rick in San Luis Obispo. Hi, Rick.
I think one of the reasons that they're are these problems on college campuses, quite apart from any of the things you've been talking about, is that I think young guys from a pretty early age are exposed to a lot of pornography. And I think they get the wrong idea about what women want, because there seem to be universally portrayed themes in pornographic films, which I don't really watch very often because I don't like them. But I've noticed a real similarity in treatment of women. And because young guys don't have much experience with women, and they don't really, they haven't gotten into the really interpersonal part, you know, just beyond just having sex, you know, really getting to know somebody. I think they tend to believe what they see in these films, that they're kind of ingrained attitudes. And I don't know if that's really been addressed in dealing with them.
Do you guys want to speak to that?
Yes. Thank you, Rick. You bring up a great point. And one of the things that we talk about is how do boys learn how to be men? And they learn from the people around them. They learn from schools. They learn from media. And a lot of those messages are wrong, just like you stated, right? They give ideas about how women want to be treated, or what it is to be in a relationship, or how do you even approach wanting to have sex with a woman. And they get a lot of bad information. So I absolutely agree with you that's why we call it a cultural issue and not an individual issue, because they're being given a lot of bad information.
Mm-hmm.
I think another aspect of it is that unless men are given good information, particularly in regard to how to have really good sex as opposed to, you know, just having sex, period, but really, you know, really knowing something about that. And I know it's difficult for men to actually learn this because we're still coming out of a very Victorian past where sex wasn't really discussed openly. And I don't think there was much information given. I know I certainly didn't get much information. All you get is the backroom stuff from other guys. But after quite some time of not being very successful, I learned something about sexual techniques that were developed in India hundreds of years ago, tantric yoga and spiritual sex.
Rick,
we lost Rick here.
Rick, I wanted to respond to what he just said because he brought up some really fantastic points. And I think going back to my previous bandwagon about communication and what Christina said earlier also about starting these conversations at 18 when we would love to have started these conversations years prior.
Yeah.
And you're getting messaging through pornographic films that are saying, oh, women like this, that, and the other. And every single woman has different sexual preferences. So going in with an assumption that women like X, Y, and Z, like cookie cutter style, that's not going to work. And so people get into trouble when they make assumptions, right? You know what they say about making assumptions.
Right.
And then they go with that. And the only way to know, again, is to ask, is to have a conversation. And so there is a space like men and masculinity has to start having those. How do you have those conversations? How do you talk about sex with a partner when nobody taught you to even have those conversations?
Right. Well, and I want to add, too, that this is not a place for women to go either, you know, having conversations.
Correct.
About likes and dislikes. It's been verboten in a lot of cultures, in a lot of upbringing. It's not an easy conversation. So there's this vacuum.
Correct.
That's happening for information.
It speaks to how we teach girls to be women and
right.
How we teach us, you know, how we have learned to communicate as well. And I know we're going down this, you know, this path about healthy sexuality, which I think is really important. And I also really want to be clear that oftentimes one of the myths out there is that sexual assault is just bad sex.
Yeah.
Right.
And so we want to be really clear that's not what we're talking about here, because there's a huge difference between bad sex, not knowing what you're doing, and doing something that the other person does not want to do. Right?
Right.
And so we're just all wanting to constantly really clear about that.
Yeah, and let's talk about the other thing in the room too, which is about dominance, about domination, about people feeling unable to speak for themselves, take care of themselves. Stand up for themselves. When you're talking about harassment, you've got an imbalance of power.
And that's really the terms we use is mm-hmm. we talk about power imbalances,
yeah.
Right? And so in the big picture, the power imbalances, we can see, you know, women still are making, you know, anywhere between 60 and 78 cents on the dollar, depending on race, to men's wages. We do not have equal representation in our government or in our CEOs or in media outlets, right? And so our voices are not as heard or present.
Mm-hmm.
And so we continue to have power imbalances where gender and race and sexual orientation, all those things intersect to create situations where this is used as a tool, where sexual assault is used. It's, you know, one of the most horrific tools used in war mm-hmm. around our world still.
Right.
And so, yeah.
Yeah, and I just wanted to add that that's what the norm is. And so when we're asking people to go outside of those socialized norms of, you know, how power works, and how violence, and, you know, even bringing in what this person talked about with porn, and, you know, we live in a culture where that's kind of the way that we do it. So to ask parents an example is that I talk with lots of parents when their students are dropping them off, and we have them come to our booth, and they're like, "Oh, we don't need to have that conversation. My son is good." And then the parents of mothers are frantically coming to, "Well, okay, what is this information?"
Yeah.
We see that in this kind of that dynamic of we don't really need to talk to our sons, and we're scared for our daughter's safety. And, you know, it starts very young. So just bringing it back to that, those kind of like normalized views of how power works, and, you know, how boys will be boys. That starts as my son's 3 and a half. That starts for him right now in preschool, where teachers, male or female, they allow it, they encourage it, right? And so there's ways to intervene at that young of an age that can then follow the person till their adulthood. But I think it's uncomfortable and it's different, and so people avoid it, even if in their gut they know, oh man, I kind of get the sense that this is wrong, but it's too scary for me to actually do something different, so I'm just going to go against my gut and do what everyone else is doing.
Is there a movement toward, you're talking about educating men, young boys, about being more aware about their behavior? And are we doing the same thing for girls too at the same time?
Because one thing that jumps up is the difference between prevention and risk reduction. Mm-hmm. And
yeah.
I think for years they did, and I'm using air quote, prevention with women, with this notion that if you do A, B, C, D, E,
self-defense,
like you can prevent an assault from happening. But when you boil it down to the basics, the only one who can actually prevent it is the person who is actually doing it.
Right.
Exactly. And so we can have conversations with women about safety, about risk reduction, but ultimately the perpetrators are the ones that we're having conversations, or potential mm-hmm. perpetrators are the ones that we're having conversations about prevention.
Mm-hmm. And the truth is, I always encourage people, talk to your friends. This is not something that as women we talk about, but we have all been raised with the fear of rape mm-hmm. since mm-hmm. the time we were little girls, right? And Chris, mm-hmm. you're shaking your head. You and I have not had this conversation, but
sure.
we know this.
Oh, yeah.
From not going to the bathroom alone, right? And so this isn't a new thing for women to be aware of. We're raised with it, but highlighting it as a risk for boys and parents, I think it's imperative. And one of the things that we talk a lot about at RISE is, you know, we live in this beautiful community, San Luis Obispo County. We're the happiest town. We're, you know, our housing's so expensive because everybody wants to live here and it's beautiful. And one of the questions we all get asked a lot is, what do you do for a living? And, what does RISE do? And we have rape here. We have domestic violence here. And people don't believe it. And so we do. We have a waiting list of over 160 people waiting to get in for counseling services. Our shelters are full. Our services are impacted. And I know that it's the same for Christina on campus. But one of the things that gives me so much hope is our community is a community of first adopters. You know, we got rid of smoking in public. We were the first city, you know, to implement those ordinances,
right.
And plastic bags, and now straws, right? So we care in this community about health and safety.
Mm-hmm.
And this issue is about health and safety, right? Mm-hmm. And so how do we bring this into mainstream awareness? Just like issues that are so important, like our environment. These are about our people. These are about, you know, our community members. And yes, this happens primarily to women and girls, but there are a ton of men and boys out there that have been impacted as well. I know them. We serve them, mm-hmm. Friends with them, and their stories and the lifelong impact for them is just mm-hmm. as impactful.
So what does the community do? I mean, with that knowledge of having a goal of going forward and being actionable, what can the general person do?
Donate to RISE.
Thanks, Christina. I paid her to say that beforehand. There's lots of things.
Yeah.
And it ranges from, you know, getting involved with RISE and our events or activities. We had a Men in the Me Too Movement panel of men in the community that spoke back in January, and then we did a follow-up on Cal Poly campus in March.
And what was the response to that? Was it good?
Really good. It was pretty amazing. And I was really impressed. It was a full house, and
we had over 100 people, and more than 50% of them were men.
There's this notion that, okay, well, I don't rape people, so then I'm good, right? But is there more you can do? So there, like mm-hmm. Jenny was saying, there are opportunities for people to get involved, whether they want to volunteer, whether they want to donate, or they want to just start having these conversations with other men in their lives.
Yeah.
So that's what we talk about, right? Have these conversations. Mm-hmm. Talk to your friends. Talk to your sons. Talk to your wives and daughters. Get really real about what those experiences are, because when you don't have to worry about that, you're not thinking about it. It's not in your conscious. It's not in your forefront. But if you talk to your female friends and ask them, what do you think about this? How's the Me Too movement impacted you? Do you have a history with this? What is it that you would ask men to do differently in your circle and in your life? Talk to your friends about it. The men that sat on our panel, I was so impressed in both of our panels. Mm-hmm. They actually all shared instances that they had to own and say, I'm sorry I did this, and I had to go back, and you know, or I couldn't go back because I did this 20 years ago, right? But now I'm aware that was a mistake, mm-hmm. and that was putting a woman in a position that she was going to feel uncomfortable or not have power.
And I would also add to that, is if you're in a position of being able to integrate education into your workplace, if you're the leader and you can acknowledge that this is something as a supervisor, as the leader, as the owner, I need to be integrating into my annual training of my staff, then to try and do that, reach out. There's lots of organizations that can help provide that. Mm-hmm. You can start with talking to RISE or SAFER. We can always suggest or make a plan with you. And it will take those conversations and action, because I think that, you know, the conversations are happening more so than they have in the past, but it's that next step of planning, okay, how am I going to be doing my work differently this year than mm-hmm. I was last year.
And it's not to create a sterile environment.
No.
There's that assumption of, oh, I can't say anything, I can't do anything, I can't look at anybody, I can't. It's not that.
No, absolutely not. And again, you know, as Chris keeps saying, communication.
Which
but
Chris,
it's,
by the way.
I'm sorry.
It's so scary.
There's only three of you here. You know, when we talk about prevention and we talk about public health, there's a spectrum that things have to happen on. It's individual level, group level, organizational level, and policy level. And so all of those different levels, and I love that example, Christina, of the, you know, workplace. If you coach a soccer team, if you coach a kids' soccer team,
right.
How do you talk to the kids? What are ways that you can incorporate respect and communication in these cornerstones that we're talking about so that it's different for them? If you're a parent, do you have a parents group? Do you need to figure out how to talk to your teenage son or daughter about these issues? Mm-hmm. You know, we're available for all those types of discussions. And then the final one is policies. What are the policies in your school district? How do they handle accusations of sexual harassment or sexual assault? What resources do they have available? What are our policies at the city and county levels when it comes to these types of issues? So it's
and do we enforce them?
Do we enforce them? Mm-hmm. Do we enforce them?
We can have policies.
Oh my goodness, right?
Yeah, we can have policies.
That's a great point, yeah.
I'm Chris Kington, and you're here on Central Coast Voices on KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. If you just joined us and you want to hear this entire show, all local programs on, say, KCBX are available on demand by going to kcbx.org and clicking on demand under the How to Listen tab on our menu. Then just click on the show that you want for the drop-down menu, and you'll get your selections. The most recent show will pop up. My guests today are Jennifer Adams, Executive Director for Rise of San Luis Obispo County, Chris Rodebush, Marriage and Family Therapist, and Christina Caviani, Director of Safer and Men and Masculinity Programs at Cal Poly SLO. We have about 10 minutes left and time for another phone call, maybe just one. In today's show, you can call us at 805-781-3875. Again, 805-781-3875. And when we're talking about, you were discussing men kind of calling on other men and saying, wait a minute, dude, you know, that's not cool. That's not okay. What were you hearing from the men really prevents that action from happening? What is it that they're saying themselves, wow, you know, in the moment, I just didn't think to do that.
As far as in a sexual experience?
Or languaging, or maybe.
I think you're talking like in a group setting with other men, and what are the barriers to speaking up?
Yeah, the barriers to speaking
right.
up.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's the social pressure of just fitting in. I mean, 18 is not that different than 15, you know, and so there is that pressure to be cool and not say anything and go against, you know, what you feel. You know, I always say this to men, like, how would you be handling a situation if your mother were to walk in? You know, language are you going to use? How are you going to treat someone? And it is very different than in an all-male, you know, group. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of research around, you know, groupthink when you're around, you know, all the same type of people, that you're less likely to say something or speak up when there's more than four people around. So there's a whole psychology of bystander intervention and groupthink that we study. But I think...
Well, I was just going to say, but we also know in those situations that all it takes is one person to speak up.
And then others will follow.
Yes, right, because what they oftentimes find is they're not the only ones who are thinking that.
That are saying, this is so wrong.
Right. Yeah. You know, I had David Lee with CalCasa, who's I've been, you know, training with forever, talks about, you know, a bunch of college friends wanting to go to a strip club and, you know, to celebrate somebody's birthday, and he didn't want to go. And so... it took him a while, but he finally spoke up and said he wasn't cool with that. He wasn't comfortable with it. And then found out all of the guys didn't want to go either, right? So it's
probably even the guy that suggested it really didn't want to go.
Right. So we're always surprised. Mm-hmm. We think everybody else is thinking, you know, over here. And we're surprised when that's actually not the case. And
so
it takes
that,
risks.
Is that something that is actively being taught to kids? Is speaking up?
I think parents have more ability to intervene on it. But I don't think there's as much intentionality that's occurring. Because I think it is uncomfortable, you know, and I...
Well, let's just think just in general, you know, not necessarily being a sassy mouth, but being able to state an opinion or being able to say, no, I don't want to do that. I don't want to go there.
I liken it to, I have to, you know, I've been doing this work for a long time, so I'm always looking for the hope, right? The beacons of hope that this is doable, right? So I go back to, I talk about public health models like seatbelts. You know, we didn't used to wear seatbelts,
right?
And now nobody would dream of getting in the car, and especially our children, without being, you know, buckled in. And when we think about language, if we're talking about harassment, you know, we used to use really pejorative terms with regards to race, with regards to LGBTQI community.
Right.
And we have really, our culture has changed, right? Those are not acceptable mainstream words to use anymore. And you rarely hear them. Mm-hmm. And if you do, it catches your attention and there's a lot of pushback and outcry towards it, right? So that gives me hope that we can do the same thing.
It seems like it needs to be a multi-level approach.
Yes.
It, at every level, at every age, trying to just hit pockets of it is, you know, going to have some effect. But it really seems like it needs to be as broad as we can find it.
Well, it's been, when the movement started, when rape crisis centers were being created back in the 1970s, you know, this has been seen as a women's issue, right? Women run the organizations, we're the ones at the marches, and so we've been carrying the load. And what we know is that this will not change and it will not stop until we are all committed and all in on it.
Are you seeing that more men are getting involved with the agencies now?
Yes. We have, on our staff, we have almost a third of our staff. I might be maybe a quarter now because we just expanded a little bit. Between a quarter and a third of our staff are men, which when I started, there was no men in the organization that I worked in. And I've been so happy with what has come out of our men's panels. Mm-hmm. And we're looking at what we're going to continue and what we're going to do in October to continue that conversation.
And it's seen in our board of directors as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, actually half of my board of directors are men now. And, you know, and really vocal.
Right.
Champions for talking about it.
Which is what you need.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Both women and men. Yeah.
Yes. And men who are willing to come up and say they were victims.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's an important voice that has been missing at the table, is male victims. And, you know, and I've been schooled on that several times because I can tend to really focus on coming from the women's, you know, perspective. And this impacts everyone, whether you know it or not. It impacts everyone because women adjust their behavior accordingly. Men are, you know, becoming more and more aware or sensitive to it, feeling like they can't talk about it. People who have been victimized, their surrounding circles are all impacted by this, and the ways that victims are impacted with health and mental health issues and substance abuse issues, it affects their ability to go to work and show up and do their work well.
I think it's sometimes you just have to look at the numbers. If you take the 1 in 4, and it's about 1 in 10 for men, 1 in 4 women in their lifetime, 1 in 10 men. And you consider you have a mother, a sister, a daughter.
Right.
You have friends and acquaintances and employees and colleagues that are women. How many people in your life have been affected and you may not know?
Right.
You may know some of it. You may know all of it. But it's an everyone issue. It is not just a women's issue.
Well, we have about 3 minutes, so I want to give each of you a minute to kind of wrap up. And if you wanted to say something specific, or I'm going to start with you, Christina.
Sure. I'll say that, you know, I think as a country, we're moving past the awareness, and we're now in the phase. We're aware that it's a problem, and that now we are in the proactive, let's do something now. So I guess I would really encourage people to take a deep dive into all aspects of their life and, you know, without guilt and with, you know, openness, think of how they themselves and the communities that they're a part of, they can integrate this work and really come from a place of action. Because I think that's what it's going to need to happen in this next phase to change our slow community to be a safer place and to make sure that we're really taking care of our community members.
Great.
I think I would like to add that in having all of these conversations, often, like I said earlier in the show, people can be triggered. And if this is true for you, I want to just encourage you to, one, just take care of yourself. Give yourself time and space to reflect or take care of yourself, whether that means going on a walk or petting one of your lovely kitties or doggies at home, and or if it means it's time for you to seek out therapy and have and do some deeper work on this level, I just want you to make sure that you're taking care of yourself. And yeah, that's all.
And I will do the, you know, riseslow.org website. It has so much information about services, about ways to get involved. We have a 24-hour crisis line for anyone that might have been triggered or know someone that has experienced this, and we're available to help. I absolutely believe in this community and our ability to be first adopters here and really create change. And I really appreciate you, Chris, paying attention to this issue and inviting us on.
Oh, it's great to have you. And I wanted to say something real quick on what you said, Christina, too. You were talking about, I think, really no shame, no blame, too. Mm-hmm. It's time to step beyond that and to get into what can we do. We can talk about it. We can feel bad about it. And yes, that helps. But the other thing is that we need to also figure out where do we go forward to fix it? Because just being upset about it or angry or feeling guilty is not going to get it done. Mm-hmm. So you have your phone number.
Is 805, which we have to say now.
I know.
226-5400. 24 hours. There's always someone available to talk to you and provide help. And the riseslow.org website. We're on Facebook, Instagram. There's lots of information on there for people either seeking how to get involved or that need help.
Okay, great. And thank you all for coming. I want to thank my guests for today's show, Jennifer Adams, Executive Director for Rise of San Luis Obispo County, Chris Rodebush, Marriage and Family Therapist, Christina Caviani, Director Safer and Men and Masculinity Programs at Cal Poly SLO. Next week, join host Fred Monroe as he speaks with artistic and acting company members for the Central Coast Shakespeare Festival in their 2018 summer season. Central Coast Voices is sponsored by Action for Healthy Communities and the San Luis Obispo Community Foundation in collaboration with KCBX. The show is made possible by underwriting by Joan Geller Sargent. I'm Chris Kington Barker, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.